This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with the second day of our late night week. Later this week, we'll hear from Jimmy Kimmel, Jimmy Fallon, and Questlove, who leads the band The Roots, and will be moving with Fallon to The Tonight Show early next year. Later in today's show, we'll feature an interview with Conan O'Brien. First, we have an interview with Jay Leno, recorded in October 1996 after the publication of his memoir, Leading With My Chin. Leno succeeded Johnny Carson as the host of The Tonight Show in 1992. Although it's a position he'd always dreamed of, he left The Tonight Show in September of 2009 to start his own primetime show on NBC. And Conan O'Brien became the new host of The Tonight Show. But just a few months later, in January of 2010, Leno's show was canceled. In a very controversial move, he returned to The Tonight Show, leaving O'Brien without a TV home, until a few months later when O'Brien started a new late-night show on TBS. Next February, Leno will leave The Tonight Show for the second, and we assume, final time, and it will be Jimmy Fallon's turn to take over. Before we hear the interview, our TV critic David Bianculli is going to talk about Jay Leno's contributions to late-night TV. Hey, David, welcome back.
This is fun. I'm glad to be here.
And you brought a clip to get us started before hearing the Jay Leno interview. What did you bring?
This is Jay Leno's first appearance on the old Tonight Show. What's great about hearing these old clips is that you can hear that they're going over with the audience. And these are people, nobody knew who Jay Leno was, and he's out there in a horrible 70s suit, but he had good jokes.
David Janssen's commercial for Excedrin? Man, looks like a headache. See, when I was a kid, we were never allowed to have headaches. See, my folks grew up during the Depression. So consequently, they make you feel very guilty about everything, you know? I mean, even now I go home for a weekend. Hey, Dad, pass the salt.
We never had salt when we were kids. We had to live without salt. We didn't have underwear or potatoes. We ate dirt every day of the week. Your mother and I hunted wild dog for food. We had nothing when we were your age.
That's Jay Leno in 1977, his first appearance on The Tonight Show. Now that Leno is preparing to leave The Tonight Show for real
again,
this time,
yeah.
How would you describe his place in late-night TV?
Well, what he ended up doing was finding an acceptable average. I mean, when he started, when he was up against Letterman, Letterman beat him for the first couple of years. But then once Leno came ahead, he was unstoppable. He never lost that audience. And the reason why NBC did all the dumb things it did with primetime and bringing him back is because Jay Leno had numbers that nobody else was getting. And so he was very successful. And I think he was successful at being middle of the road, at being a broadcast comic, which is what The Tonight Show certainly was under Johnny and under Jack Paar and under Steve Allen. And he did continue that.
So middle of the road wins the big numbers.
Well, it does, except the numbers are shrinking now and the audience is changing now, and how much of a television program they're watching or whether they're even watching it on television is changing now.
You told me a great story that I'd like you to tell our listeners. You interviewed Leno when he was in that transition, leaving The Tonight Show and preparing to host his new 10 o'clock primetime show.
Yeah, he's kind of wary of the press. I mean, it's pretty much a given that more people prefer Letterman to Leno, and he feels the heat of all of that. But I started off the interview by reading a couple of quotes of people basically saying this new guy is never going to match the old guy, and The Tonight Show is just a shadow of what it was, and I don't know what NBC was thinking. And he's going, how many more of these am I going to have to hear? And I read him two or three, and then I said, these are from 1962 when Johnny Carson took over for Jack Paar. And suddenly he lightened up, I mean, completely, and he sort of talked about the idea that in history, when a popular host leaves and another one comes in, no matter how good that person may be, there's a learning curve and there's a resistance. So he got that part of his place in history.
So, David, why don't we hear the interview that I recorded with Jay Leno? This was back in 1996, just before his program celebrating his fifth anniversary as the host of The Tonight Show.
Okay.
Jay Leno, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Like most young comics, your ambition when you were starting out was to eventually get onto The Tonight Show.
Yeah.
What was the most memorable part of your first shot on The Tonight Show?
Most memorable would be, I got heckled my first shot, which was a horrible experience. But luckily, I'd worked a lot of clubs, so I could deal with that. And Johnny seemed to like that. But our producer, Fred DeCordova, he would say to you, okay, here's the deal. He would come over and he would say, and Fred was somewhat of a legendary figure, having, you know, directed Jack Benny and all these people. He would say, after you do your stand-up routine, if I go like this, waving my hands towards me, that means come over and sit down to Johnny. If I put my hand up like this, stay on your mark. If I wave you away, go behind the curtain. But whatever you do, don't move until you get my signal. I said, yes, sir. I walk out, I do my routine. Thank you, good night. Big laughs. Hannah, thank you very much. I look over and I see Fred about to signal me and his phone rings. And I see him, hello? And now he's talking and I don't know what to do. And the audience is now getting into that, you know, down to that odd one or two claps. And I'm still standing there. So the applause picks up a little bit more as if people are going, oh, all right, just get lost, will you? You know, and I'm going, hi. And he's talking away, you know, da-da-da-da-da-da. Now the applause is all but stopped. Fred puts the phone down. He looks over, completely forgetting. I go, oh, come here. Come on. Oh, thank you. You know, I realize it was only maybe 6-7 seconds. But, of course, to me, I might as well have been out there an hour and a half at this point, just hanging, waiting to get Fred's signal to come over and sit down next to Johnny. So that was pretty scary.
On your first shot on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson, mm-hmm. did he laugh at your jokes?
Yeah, he was very good, actually. He was a terrific audience. I mean, that's what The Tonight Show is. It's not trying to get the audience to laugh. It's trying to get Johnny to laugh.
Right.
But, you know, the
right.
audience gets the cue from the host.
Right.
And if Johnny is laughing, they're enjoying it more.
Did Johnny Carson give you advice about your stand-up act or later on about guest hosting or hosting when you took over?
Not so much about hosting, but he did about, the first time I did The Tonight Show. Well, actually, I was a guy that was sort of the last of my graduating class to do The Tonight Show. By graduating class, I mean all the guys I sort of started with, Robin Williams and, Letterman and guys like George Miller and so many of the comics, they all did it before me. And, you know, Johnny came in one night at the Improv to see me. Harvey Korman brought him in. And, you know, there are two kind of comedians. There are comedians that have a lot of attitude and not many jokes. There are comedians that have a lot of jokes but not much stage persona. By attitude, I mean those kind of comics can get on stage and go, hey, pal, nice hat. All right, what did you win? Did somebody guess your weight? You know, that kind of thing. And they're loud and they're boisterous and they're just funny in their nature, but there are no jokes. And then there are other comedians like, you take a guy like Stephen Wright, who are just natural joke writers. You know, very monotone. They tell the joke a certain way. And to me, the best comedians are the ones that combine both those elements. You have a joke and you have an attitude. I remember Johnny came to see me and he said, you know, he thought I was funny, but I wasn't ready for the show because my jokes were too far apart. You know, I didn't quite understand what he meant, but I listened. And then I started watching his monologue, and I realized, you know, he was doing 15 or 20 jokes in a space where I was doing 5. I mean, I could get on stage and being sort of physically big and loud and imposing, I could get a laugh where there wasn't any. But that was great for a nightclub, but not for TV. You know, the idea being on television, if the joke doesn't work, your funny attitude will carry you through. And if your funny attitude doesn't carry you through, your joke will carry you through. And if they both work, you got a killer joke, you know?
Now, how do you work up your opening monologue?
How?
Well, and how do you feel, and also how do you feel about having writers writing with you? I'm sure during the years that you were doing clubs, you were writing all your own material. And
I was writing all my own stuff. And there's this arrogance that a lot of comedians had, and I certainly have it. Or at least had it, you know, well, I can do this. I can handle it. I mean, like the first 15 to 20 times I hosted The Tonight Show, I said, I don't need cue cards. I'll memorize it. And I did okay. But then I realized this is ridiculous. If you're going to do this every day, you can't memorize, you know, 11 and a half minutes worth of jokes. I mean, you'll go nuts. You'll go crazy trying to do this. And then I gradually got into it. And now the way it works is, well, we tape the show from 5 to 6. Then we have a meeting. I go home at maybe 7:30, 8 o'clock. 9 o'clock, I start to put the monologue together. 11 o'clock, Jimmy Brogan, he's the guy working on the monologue. We go through maybe 500 or 600 jokes that we've prepared that day, or everybody's prepared. And they're not all jokes. Some are just punchlines. Some are just setups. Some are, did you hear about the guy who did this odd thing in Iowa? Question mark. We try to make a joke out of that. Sometimes it's a complete joke from a writer. Anyway, we'll try and put at least half the monologue together by 2 or 3 in the morning. And then I get into work about 8:30, and through the course of the day, and you're writing jokes constantly as you're picking the red M&Ms out of some rock group's, you know, dressing room, because whatever, you know, you're still dealing with show business people, you know.
When you were starting in comedy, there uh-huh. weren't comedy clubs yet, not as we know them. Some of the venues that you played included retirement homes, prisons, mental hospitals. This is through a state program in Massachusetts where yeah. I think you got like $10.
We used to get $10 a show to do old people's birthday parties for yeah. the state. We used to do prisons. I did a show at like Walpole State Prison. And prisoners are not a good audience, you know. Because comedy is based on a certain civility. Hi, folks, how are you? You know, and when you got a guy sitting in the front row and he's got a little blonde kid on a choke chain wearing underpants sitting on the floor next to him, that's not an ideal audience, you know?
What material would you do in your prison?
Just do your regular act. I only had my act growing up, whatever. You know, I used to do these psychiatric homes, and they get like, you know, and this is not to make fun of psychiatric patients, but, you know, you go out there, hi, everybody, how you doing? And then, like, in the middle of your act, there'd be a guy in the corner going, ah! Ah! And then orderlies would come in. And of course, this would just break the mood of the whole room, you know. Say, anybody here from Boston? Ah! Ah! You know, hey, calm down there, fella. How you doing? You know.
Well, did this give you confidence performing in front of people?
Well, it was fascinating yeah. because you realized, it wasn't until I performed at, like, this place called Lenny's on the Turnpike in Boston, that I ever got a professional audience. You know, I could always say in my own mind, well, you know, the audience, it's a psychiatric hospital. They didn't laugh because there's obviously something wrong with them.
Well, you can say, right, they don't laugh. You They're know, crazy.
Yeah, it was like strip clubs.
Yeah.
When I would play strip clubs, they wouldn't laugh or applaud or do anything. But it gave you the confidence just to stand on stage because the people weren't paying any attention to me anyway. I mean, there's a story in the book about playing this club called the Mineshaft, where it was in Minnesota. People would pay $5 to get in, and then for another $5, the customers would get a miner's hat with a light on it. Now, there were no lights in the club. It was just a big, empty building. And the women would come out and dance, and of course, the guys had the lights on their heads, and they would look at whatever part of the woman they wanted to look at with the light, and I would just be standing in the darkness. Telling jokes. Hi, everybody. How you doing? Occasionally, somebody would look over at me, and I couldn't even look at them because they had the bright light on their head. So if they looked at me, ow, it burned my eye. I had to look away. So most of the time, for the whole week, I was just standing in darkness while guys looked at these women with those miners' hats on.
You were probably one of the most hardworking comics in show business when you were getting started, just performing anywhere and everywhere
yeah.
to get experience. But sometimes you'd get billed, you'd get booked in really inappropriate places. And my favorite story about that is when you were booked, I guess it was in a Catskill resort, at a Hasidic, at an Orthodox Jewish resort.
Yeah, there was this...
You were booked as what? Tonight, Jay Leno, Jewish storyteller?
I was billed as a Jewish storyteller.
What did you do?
This agent in New York would come into the clubs and he'd say, I need a comic this Saturday, pays $50, you know. And I remember one time, before I get that story, this guy sent me up to a job and it paid $100 for the weekend. And I thought, well, that's pretty good, $100 for the weekend. And I remember afterwards, the owner of the hotel came over and said, boy, that was very good. You know, normally we don't like to spend $1,200 on an act, but we really enjoyed you. And I realized the agent took, you know, $1,100 commission out of my $100. You know, it was just a nightmare. Anyway, that was the last time I worked from him. And the first time, he sends me up to the Catskills at the Chaim Resort or something like this. And I said, well, what is it? It's just a nightclub. I said, what kind of... I said, is it mostly... Oh, no, go up there. So I finally find this place, and it's all these cabins way back in the woods. And nice people, but it's a Hasidic resort. And I pull in there, and it says on one of these one of those bad signs that, you know, you pull on a trailer and it's got the flashing lights around it. Tonight, Jay Leno, Jewish storyteller. And I go, so I get there and I walk out on stage and it's all Hasidic, you know, and I don't even speak Hebrew or, you know. And I said, listen, it's been a big mistake. You know, I'm not really a storyteller. I'm not even Jewish. The guy made a mistake. A lot of, and then this guy, so do your act. Let's see what you do, you know. So I did my, and they were very nice. And, I mean, they were polite. You know, you just, you know, I felt bad for them and they felt bad for me. And they were nice people. It just, it wasn't what they had bought, you know. You know, it was a horrible job.
You know, I think it's funny, in your book you talk about how when you were getting started in comedy, or maybe this was even before you got started, when you were growing up, that comics meant adult guys, usually from New York, usually Jewish, who spoke more to your father than they spoke to you.
That's true. When I was a kid, you had Alan King, you had Rodney Dangerfield, and these guys were always funny, but they always came from the point of view, at least to me, was these kids today with the long hair, you can't tell the boys from the girls, I tell you, you know. And all that was funny. My father would laugh at that. And then I remember seeing Robert Klein and George Carlin and David Brenner and Steinberg, and these guys would come out. And suddenly I noticed I was laughing more than my dad because their humor was coming more from my point of view, especially Robert Klein. He was a guy who was, I felt, like me, middle class, normal parents, not easy, not rich, not poor, just normal. You know, watched the same TV shows as a kid that I watched. Joked about the same kind of things that I watch. And that was a big change in comedy, at least for me.
So how did you figure out where your material was going to be?
I figured it out from watching those guys. You know, I said to myself, boy, these guys make fun of the same kind of things that I think are funny. These are the same things I talk about with my friends. I mean, prior to them, I don't think you would have seen Alan King come on the Ed Sullivan show and do jokes about Jimi Hendrix. You know, it just didn't happen. You know, it didn't happen.
No, it would be about Jimi Hendrix mowing his lawn.
Right. Jimi Hendrix with a hair like that, you know. But, I mean, suddenly here were guys on mainstream television talking about things only kids, you know. Now adults buy Rolling Stone albums, you know what I'm saying? But
back in
the 70s, there were adult records, you know, which you had Henry Mancini and Frank Sinatra. And then you had, for the kids, you know, the Rolling Stones and the Beatles, whatever. And nobody ever did jokes about the Beatles on mainstream television. These were the first comedians to sort of parody younger people's lifestyles.
You know, we were talking about how hardworking you were as a young comic, just trying out everything that you could, playing every place you could play. When you moved to Los Angeles, you moved there before you had a home, before you had any money, and you often ended up just like sleeping on the steps of the comedy clubs or sleeping in the alleys by the comedy clubs.
I used to get picked up in L.A. for vagrancy. And what the cops would do is they just put you in the back of the car and you just drive around with them on their shift all night. And being a comic, you know, this worked, well, somewhat to my advantage, but actually, no. The first time I got picked up, you know, they'd say, let's move along. Where do you live? I don't kind of live anywhere. All right, get in the car. What do? I'm a comedian. Oh, yeah? Tell us a joke, you know. So then you'd sort of try and come up with every dirty joke you could think of to tell these cops all night. And har, that was Lila. And then that worked pretty good. Well, they let me go. But then two or three nights would go by and the cops would go, hey, are you that comedian guys our partner picked up the other night? Yeah. You get in the car. All those jokes you would tell. So, you know, two or three nights a week, I'd have to ride around until dawn telling jokes to different cops because they would say, hey, have you seen that kid on the street? Pick him up. He's got some funny jokes.
It must be strange for you, knowing so many comics so well and having been in the position of being a young, hardworking comic really wanting their big break, to now be the guy who could give a young, hardworking comic
a big
break.
Oh, man, it's a nightmare.
And I'm sure you don't want to hurt anybody's feelings. On the other hand, you want to have the best show you possibly can. So it's probably a really awkward spot.
No, it's horrible because I used to think, well, now that I'm hosting The Tonight Show, I can go anywhere. But now you can't go anywhere because you walk in and you go, oh, gee, there's Larry. I got to hide. You know, I mean, that's what it is. I mean, you know, you have friends that come up to you that, you know, it's when I first got the job, men, women, comedians would come up to me and they go, hey, Jay, you know, Johnny would never put me on, but now you got the show. It'll be great, man. I can come on all the time. And I'd have to say, but, you know, if you weren't good enough to get on with Johnny, it's not good enough to get on with me. You got to make it funnier. And, you know, I lost a lot of friends that way. I mean, it's just there are people that I love dearly as friends, but the material is not strong enough, or maybe it's really old-fashioned. You know, it's just, you know, old jokes about, I don't know, hippies or airline food or whatever it is. And you just say, you know, you got to update the stuff. And they just don't get it.
Jay Leno recorded in 1996. He leaves The Tonight Show in February. Our late night series continues in the second half of the show. Each day, the interviews from our late night series will be added to our late night theme page and available for downloading on our website, freshair.npr.org. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.